I think I'll just get started because it's 7 now, and people can continue coming in as I'm speaking. Hello again to those of you returning from last week. I'm Mary Wild. This is the second lecture in the Cinema Hysteria course. Thanks to everyone for being here tonight. Nice to see some of you attending from last week, and welcome to those who are just joining this week. Let me just double check that I haven't... yes. Okay. So just for those of you who are new to the course, just a bit of background about myself. I'm from Montreal originally, but I'm now over here working at the BFI and delivering lectures in my projection series. And the aim is to explore ideas in film through Freudian concepts. In addition to the Freud Museum, I've also lectured at the SAE Institute, CityLit, and the BFI. This lecture has been programmed as part of the Mad, Bad, and Sad series, currently on at the Freud Museum until the 2nd of February. There's brochures around the museum if you'd like to have a look. And so the course is called Projection Cinema Hysteria, and I'm basically looking at the condition of hysteria via the sort of disciplines of film and psychoanalysis. Last week, we looked predominantly at erotic and romance films, and we were just sort of laying down the groundwork of basically the discourse of seduction that's been prescribed against which women measure and identify their femininity. So we looked at concepts like kalon kakon, which is the ancient Greek idea or concept of the beautiful bad thing, beautiful evil, which was designated as a definition for the woman because she's irresistible and beautiful, but simultaneously dangerous and threatening. We also considered concepts of fetishism and voyeurism as strategies of containment in response to the sometimes threatening and engulfing feminine sexuality. We considered the case study of Dora, who was one of Freud's earlier patients, the 18-year-old girl who was receiving sexual advances from a man whose wife was having an affair with her father. So she was caught up in this mixture of Oedipal identifications and conflicts, but also really sort of the case had heuristic value, even though Freud sometimes said that he was disappointed with the case because she didn't finish treatment. It did have heuristic value, especially for Lacan, because he thought that it was a great segue into the question of studying femininity. What does it mean to be a woman? What does a woman have if she can make a man fall in love with her, etc., etc.? So that was the sort of groundwork we laid down last week. So we're going to leave that there and move on to tonight. The focus tonight is looking at the sort of condition of being possessed by various things, possessed by notions of what femininity means, prescribed by Hollywood, possessed by the sort of ideas and taboos connoted and related to sex, and also the myths that have been built up over the years from ancient times to now, which are centered on the feminine condition and the feminine body. And so we'll look at films from the horror and melodrama genres to illustrate and create, like, as I said last week, a hysteria vibe. You know, it's trying to evoke the feeling of hysteria in the room via film. So that's tonight, and then next week we'll move on from demons and hopefully transcend into the third and final installment of the course, looking at transformation, apotheosis, and catharsis as resolutions of the condition of hysteria, and we'll be sort of looking to films in the genres of science fiction and fantasy to, again, sort of visually, cinematically explore these ideas. It's worth saying that cinema and psychoanalysis were born at the same time, in the same year, in fact. Just as the Lumière brothers were screening the results of their newly developed cinematograph in 1895, Sigmund Freud and Joseph Breuer published their groundbreaking papers, Studies on Hysteria. And just as the patients at the Saint-Étrier Hospital in Paris jerked into hysterical fits and behaved with a certain automatism, the cinema brought what had previously been inanimate to life in mechanical fits and starts. So it's kind of interesting parallels. And it brings me really to touch on the presence of movement, really, in this course. You know, right from the origins of the word hysteria, so intimately connected with the ideas of the wandering, roaming womb, and then sort of coming into Lacan's work and the sliding signifier. And also just the very idea of the rolling film reel, you know, this constant movement, the moving image, you know, everything's always moving. And so this movement from desire to repression and then returning again. It's very interesting, just as a side note. So just a little recap for those of you who weren't here last week, just to sort of come to terms and define hysteria a little bit, but I won't linger too much on it. Joseph Breuer and Sigmund Freud had this to say about their hysterical patients in the late 1800s. They said the hysteric was at a loss to find words, and the difficulty gradually increased. With time, she became almost completely deprived of words. She put them together laboriously out of four or five languages and became almost unintelligible. In spite of making great efforts to speak, she was unable to say a syllable. So there's this sort of, idea about the barrier in the natural flow of language, something being blocked for the hysteric. She exhibits a petrified, self-conscious, anxious speech, and she's unable to demonstrate what Freud called full speech, which is free association. And the patient was, in a way, you could almost put it as she was haunted or possessed by the repressed trauma, which was converted into sensory motor physical symptoms. So she had, you know, they were demonstrating these patients had paralysis of the arm, loss of voice, blindness, deafness, seizures, convulsions. And the nature of the symptoms revealed the origin of the trauma. So, for instance, if someone complained of a tickle in the throat, it would transpire that they had actually been deeply hurt previously by the difficulty in swallowing an insult. So there was some connection, the sensory motor symptom with the original trauma. So hysteria has been called the splendid child of psychoanalysis, Freud's clinical muse, because one of his patients, as I said last week, Bertha Pappenheim, Anna O., as she was referred to, she said that, you know, whenever she talked about her problems, her symptoms would sort of almost by magic disappear. She called psychoanalysis the talking cure, which sort of stuck. Psychotherapy is the talking cure. So it's important at the outset to establish the significance of the anchoring agency in the symbolic order, the mechanism of identity formation. So in addition to the mirror stage, the process of identity formation occurs also upon initiation into the symbolic order, learning to communicate in language. This is also a very important phase in identity formation. The child acknowledges what Lacan called the name of the father, the structuring or phallic agency of a particular discourse, and defines him or herself within the parameters imposed by the name of the father. So the phallus can be thought of as the crucial signifier in the distribution of power, an authority figure, a mark of social position. You can say it's only the father, but actually you can have a phallic mother, you can have a phallic teacher. You know, it's not necessarily related to gender. And the hysteric acquisition of language involves the birth and simultaneously the repression of desires. It's quite paradoxical. And entry into social order results in the unfulfillable lack due to unending desire. And to illustrate this, all what I've just said, it helped me to understand it when I applied it to the study of Marilyn Monroe, actually, because the case of Marilyn Monroe's childhood development illustrates this point about the name of the father. So little Norma Jean, as she used to be called as a child before she changed her name, she used to go to Groman's Chinese Theater in Hollywood to watch movies all day long. Because she was always between foster homes and stuff, and the various carers would just kind of like park her at the cinema, and that was like her babysitter, but she loved it, a bit like me. Norma Jean, used to go to, you know, the cinema and watch movies all day, and she never knew her biological father, so she created one in the image of her favorite male film star, Clark Gable. As a child, she identified not only with Gable's image, but also with the world that Gable represented, the cinematic world that offered the language that Norma Jean assimilated into as a child. So she carved out her own space within this cinematic system that shaped her identity and sexuality as a woman. Marilyn unconsciously projected the nature of her identification with Clark Gable onto others in her life as well. She imagined Clark Gable to be attractive, protective, guiding, wise, and loving. So she desired to see these characteristics reflected in her husbands, drama coaches, directors, psychoanalysts, and friends. Her childhood daydreams of Clark Gable as a father figure became the filter through which all her sort of other relationships in her life would be required to pass. So this is an important point to bear in mind. Just before I introduce the next clip, Sunset Boulevard, a film directed by Billy Wilder, released in 1950, rather. So I'll just play the clip first and then discuss it afterwards. So Sunset Boulevard is a film noir about a struggling screenwriter and a faded silent movie star in Hollywood, and she dreams of a glittering comeback to the pictures, but it all ends in murder and madness. So we hear the William Holden character in the film, you know, saying, as he's describing her house, how can she breathe in that house so crowded with Norma Desmond's? More Norma Desmond's, and still more Norma Desmond's. So it sort of captures this image of, for me anyway, this sort of image of the hysteric occupying a claustrophobic space, incessantly bombarded with Hollywood's prescribed images of what she has to be like, and because she was sort of, you know, she cut her teeth in that business, presumably, in real life and also on screen. So but this is it. So she's been shaped by certain discourse of Hollywood, and she can't get away with it, from it at all. So this aging film star, she's morbidly obsessed with an image of her youth reflected back to her by the Hollywood machine. She becomes a demented, grotesque, predatory recluse in the process. And we even see, as part of the film that they're watching, the words, cast out this wicked dream which has seized my heart. I felt it wasn't accidental, really, that was included in that shot, because it's a sort of this particular idealized image of of glamorous beauty and youth acts here as a sort of possessing demon, a haunting entity that sort of engulfs her completely and controls her, and her whole home becomes a sort of shrine to this demon. Which doesn't exist in reality, but it's really controlling her life. Lacan's model of the hysterics discourse always ends in alienation for the hysteric and castration for the master. And the desire of this discourse is desire itself beyond any satisfaction. So I've got the formula here, and I'll sort of attempt to explain it. The hysteric feels an overwhelming fragmentation upon entering into language. She's haunted and possessed by this kind of lost object and longs to recover it, what she believes it will complete her. This is the object A, so the sort of lower left side, start with the A there, and then we move up. She feels alienated in language, so no word will capture the essence of the lost object. She becomes a divided subject, so that's the second point in the equation. She's propelled by a desire that insists and can never be abolished or gratified. She assumes herself to be lacking and engages in a passion of ignorance, and the other is assumed to be capable of answering her impossible question. The other is a desiring entity in the hysterics fantasy, a subject supposed to know, sujet supposé savoir, presumed proprietor of the phallic agency. The hysterical subject always makes a master out of the other. So now we've moved on to S1 here. And the S1 has to produce an answer to the burning question, an S2. But the master is also a speaking being. He or she is also alienated in language. So hysteric repeatedly elevates the master back into dominion after symbolically castrating him or her, and the master can be a teacher, a lover, analyst, political leader. Whatever the hysteric deems is the subject supposed to know. This person is going to have the answer to my burning question, my impossible question. Now, the knowledge that's generated in this equation of the discourse of the hysteric is always impotent. And does not succeed in satisfying the hysteric's original desire, her object A. It cannot possibly touch the void that set the discourse into motion in the first place, because the original demand, the elusive object A, is defined by impossibility. So the hysteric's discourse can be regarded as a useful mechanism in forcing the master to produce more signifiers and thus furthering a given theoretical model or scientific framework, constantly churning out more knowledge all the time. And in a way, you could say that this, you know, it has been said that psychoanalysis has been a successful sort of emergence from the hysteric discourse, that the original hysterical patients forced their, you know, assigned masters to produce more and more knowledge, and it developed the field of psychoanalysis. But that's, you can say that about any field. So that leads me to sort of segue into Black Narcissus, the Michael Powell and Emmerich Pressburger film from 1947, which was based on a 1939 novel by Rumer Godden. I'm going to play you a scene first of all, and it's basically about, well, the scene is, it's a nunnery, and they're getting ready to celebrate Christmas. So I'll leave it at that, and then I'll just say a few words about it afterwards. It's interesting the way they change the scene from this sort of very steely, cold, hysteric, reserved, repressed, you know, person, and then into, and then the next shot is these beautiful flowers in bloom. You know, this very interesting contrast. Just a bit of background about this film, Black Narcissus. It's the story of a group of Anglican nuns who move into the remote region of the Himalayas, and they become increasingly seduced by the sensuality of their surroundings and the mountainside. So the house of the nuns' order used to be called the House of Women, and it was sort of the local general's sort of a house of ill repute, really, where he kept his mistresses and concubines. And they renamed it the House of Saint Faith, obviously. And they then also proceeded immediately to start, you know, taking down all the pictures and any references to the previous home. So the house has a history. It's charged with a sort of unbridled sensuality, just like the area. And they start to complain of pains and headaches and spots, all these sort of physical symptoms, which they blame on the wind, the altitude, and the water. One of the sisters can't get on with her gardening. She says that she can't concentrate on planting her potatoes. She can see too far into the distance, and she doesn't even know why she's continuing with her task. She says there's some, you know, and even Mr. Dean, you know, he's heard to say there's something in the atmosphere here that makes everything seem exaggerated. Everything is heightened. Everything is very melodramatic and very, very sensual. And we hear him, you know, in the scene that we've just watched, when he's caught out for being drunk and coming to church, as he's leaving, he's sort of mocking her by saying, because she's asked him never to come back. So he starts singing, "No, I can't be a nun, for I'm so fond of pleasure, I cannot be a nun." So he's referring to the fact that in their order they've had to renounce, obviously, anything to do with their sensual life. So the very chaste and steely Sister Clodagh, who's played by a brilliant Deborah Carr, she's continually reminded of the chaos and passion that she's forsworn in her previous life, because we see that she's reminded of a former lover, you know, when she's singing the Christmas carol, and she thinks of him, her back home in Ireland, and how they were together, but it was a failed romance. And that's why she joined the Order. That's what she explains to Mr. Dean later on in the film anyway. So she gives a really good portrayal of a militantly repressed, defying, resisting woman, you know, in the face of all these temptations. And in a way, you could say, you know, referring back to the discourse of the hysteric, she's really just replaced one master signifier, one S1. For another, you know, she's gone from her romantic lover and replaced him by a new S1, her Christian faith, her religious devotion. It's always this sort of burning, you know, unending, frustrating question that always circulates and cycles up all the time. It's never really fully satisfied in her. And in contrast, we have this sort of very pent-up, ravening Sister Ruth, played by Kathleen Byron. And she's, you know, she sort of signals the dangers of surrendering to the abyss of sexual desire. And for those of you who haven't seen the film, there was a scene that I really wanted to play, but I didn't want to spoil it, because if you haven't seen it, it's such a startling moment in the scene when Kathleen Byron eventually, let's say, responds to the surroundings of where they are. So I just couldn't bring it, you know, I didn't have the heart to spoil that for those of you who haven't seen it, because it really is startling. But you can see also in the scene that Sister Clodagh is really projecting her own lustful, sort of unconscious desires onto Sister Ruth by accusing her of finding Mr. Dean attractive, which she may do, but the point is Sister Clodagh does as well, and she can't bring herself to admit it, and she's very, very pent up, very highly strung, keyed up. It's a great representation, I thought, of that condition, you know, in hysteria. So for Lacan, the symptom is a signifier that's trapped in the body. That's how he described it. The hysteric unconsciously chooses a passive way of relating to the signifier in the symbolic order, in language. So if we imagine words to be the needles that puncture the blister of emotion, the hysteric exhibits a kind of phobia of needles. She avoids, i.e. represses, the tension of the signifier, always circumventing the flow, the flow of psychic energy. And in a way, you can imagine the words being forced under house arrest inside the hysteric's body, who convinces herself that denying and ignoring the taboo word or topic will make it disappear. But that's not the case. Energy always transfers on, and it comes back in a different form, in a disguised form, hoping to avoid being repressed again. So banished signifiers, they gain potency as they roam around the hysteric's body, possessing, you know, haunting and possessing various parts of her, looking for a release. Instead of the wandering womb, it's in fact the exiled signifier that wanders, creeping up here and there, seeking liberation and expression all the time. Which brings me to my next clip, a scene from The Piano Teacher, filmed by, directed by Michael Haneke, released in 2001. It's the story of Erica, played brilliantly by Isabelle Huppert. She's a very sort of reserved, very, also very repressed music professor at a prestigious Vienna conservatory. And I'm just going to place a sequence in the film that basically relates to a student, a male young student who wants to audition for her master class and wants to impress her. I won't say anything else. We'll just say some words about it afterwards. But just bear with me. This is one of the longer scenes I'll play for you, and then we'll have a good matter about it afterwards. It's really interesting the way that Haneke uses this sort of almost subliminal messages, very startling, impulsive scenes of the boys looking at the pornography. It really clashes with the austere, general atmosphere of the rest of the scene, especially with her. But even before that, this is someone who, previously in the film, we see her going to sort of porn palace to look at X-rated videos, and that's how she sort of identifies herself in the general sphere of sexuality. So I'll just say a few words about this film. So yes, we've got Erica, a piano professor. She's in her, let's say, 40s, living with a very domineering mother. Very austere persona, very repressed, teaching with a cold, uncaring proficiency, grinding her students down. And she does have a morbid sort of fascination with sex. You see in the rest of the film, she sort of forms her identifications through pornography, extreme pornography at these places where you can go into a booth and just sort of look at X-rated adult videos. And also she's some sort of voyeur as well, because she, we see her going to a drive-in cinema, and spying on a couple having sex in a car, and she gets caught and runs away. Walter, the young student, he's very self-assured and he has a clear musical talent, and his audition for Erica's master class impresses her, because we see she's very pent up even as he's performing. She's sort of scribbling compulsively in her notebook, and the way that Hanukkah's camera catches her reaction to the performance is actually very clever, because it's sort of relentless. We just see her face, and she's absolutely transfixed by the performance. And normally she's so incredibly reserved, but you could see the emotion beneath that sort of steely stare when he's performing. She really loved his performance, but she resists the call to admit it. She resists the call to join in with the enthusiasm of the other teachers, and she refuses to nurture Walter's artistic temperaments and virtuosity. It's a really big deal to her that, you know, she remains emotionally distant, dispassionate from his performance. But she does definitely get a sort of erotic enjoyment, which is fused with piano playing. Later on, broadly in the film, we see that the way that she relates to the piano, it does border on the erotic, which is why she wants to question his motives for why he's pursuing the course. You know, is it just because he wants kudos? You know, is it just a superficial reason for pursuing the art form, or is it something deeper? You know, we're presumed to believe that for her it's something much deeper, much more intimate, sort of transcendence almost achieved, meditative state achieved through music. And so the whole business with the self-harming and the razor, if we go back to what I said previously about the signifiers being trapped in the body, let's suppose that she does, you know, feel something back for this Walter character, you know, that it's reciprocal, her feelings, she is intrigued by him, let's say romantically or sexually. The signifiers that she might want to articulate, she doesn't articulate them, she represses them. This is whole business of attraction and lust is trapped in her body and roams around looking for discharge. So the sexual self-harm, the razor to the genitalia, it serves as, I think, is a sort of dysfunctional way to release the tension in her body, somehow she can't bring herself to tell him at first. So instead she cuts herself, and it also sort of stimulates menstruation as well. And so we have this, the lyrics from a song cycle that recurs in the film, that says the lyrics are, "Why do I avoid the roads where other travelers go, seek out hidden paths through snowbound rock outcrops? And yet I've done nothing to make me flee my fellow men. What is this foolish desire driving me into the wilderness?" So she has a very sort of immature, way of dealing with her sexuality. She represses it, and then when she does eventually come to terms with it, he has to do precisely what she wants on her terms. She even writes instructions, you know, very detailed instructions about what he's supposed to do with her in a sexual encounter. So, it's as if she sort of deviated off the path of, let's say, you know, obviously, broadly speaking, just normal sexual development. She's, there's definitely some sort of, developmental stagnation there. Which leads me to talk about the hysterics body as a theater, imagined as a theater. Often, writers who've engaged with the topic of hysteria have imagined the hysterics body as a theater where repressed desires are assigned special roles in order to convey via physical symptoms the unspeakable. The body is imagined as a medium of expression precisely because language for some reason no longer suffices. The hysteric is sort of conceptualized as feeling everything strongly, you know, deeply, and storing sensations in her body, fashioning them into future symptoms. The body is regarded here as a communicative device. Her symptoms do all the talking for her. They say the things that she can't say with her words. So clinicians in this mode of understanding are encouraged to pay special attention to conversion symptoms, measuring the effectiveness of the analytic session against biological manifestations of repressed conflicts. There's a great quote from Christopher Bullas where he says, hysterical theater is always something of a seance, as ghosts of the past are brought into some strange light and the hysteric feels herself to be something of a medium for the transition of the absence into physical manifestation. This sort of seance business and ghosts fits, I thought it fit well with this section of the course, demons. This creates a sense of the self as a sacrificial host. There is true dramatic skill involved in the continuous evocation of parts of the mother, of parts of the father, or a brother, or a long since completed family event that only lives on in its theatrical rendering. The hysterical skill evolves out of a conviction that one's apparent self is to be found in the maternal narrative and performance. So now I'm going to start talking about two films that actually were released roughly around the same time, and represent the condition of being possessed by a demon. The first one is Possession, released in 1981, directed by the Polish Andrzej Zulawski. I'll just say a little bit about the clip before we watch it, just to give you a little sort of ease you into it. It's a doozy. So we've got Anna, played by Isabella Gianni. And she wants a divorce from her husband, Mark. And she sort of grows increasingly histrionic and desperate to get away from their marriage. And Mark suspects that she's having an affair, but the one she's actually being unfaithful with turns out not to even be human. Anna seems to be possessed by an evil, all-consuming force which takes control of her body, mind, and soul. And there are some really unbearably savage and violent scenes in this film. And I'm going to play one for you. sorry. But I feel like it's important because I think it really does capture this sense of, being possessed. The idea of when we say, being possessed sexually, but also, in this case, being possessed by a demon. So I'll just play you the scene and then we'll say a little bit about it afterwards. So just to set it up, this is in this scene, Mark and Anna are they're trying to have a conversation. He's trying to understand why she left, and she keeps coming back and leaving again. And he's trying to rationalize it, and he's asking her questions, but she can't really articulate what's happening to her. So I'll just play you the scene. It's difficult to know what to say after a scene like that because it's so intense, and the whole movie is really, really intense. There's a lot of scenes. That's probably the most intense scene. So there you go. If you survive that, you can watch the rest of the movie. But seriously, I find it's very I think it's worth, you know, saying a little bit about just sort of the beginning of the scene where she couldn't quite articulate, you know, what it was. Why did she have an affair? Why did she leave? Why did she ask for a divorce? Because he believed that they had a happy marriage. But he's sort of portrayed as some sort of secret agent or spy in the film. And so he was often away on special missions and left her on her own with a small child. So, that's why, you know, she did manage to actually say at the beginning, it was very difficult when you weren't here. I felt so lonely, etc., etc. So, anyway, I just find it interesting, first of all, also taking into account that the director, Andrzej Zulawski, he was actually going through a really messy divorce at the time of filming this, and I think that it's maybe materialized somehow in the ultimate cinematic texture or the narrative of the film, how he ended up filming the breaking down of this marriage, because there's so many scenes where it's very physical, it's extremely physical, and it's all, there's sort of no CGI, it's all done very, you know, realistically, and Isabel Ajani said afterwards that, you know, she was completely covered in bruises, after filming this, because there were just so many takes over and over again as well, so it was just psychologically very grueling. So the next scene is from a film called The Entity by the American Sidney Furie. It was released in 1982, so a year after. And it's basically portraying Carla, who's played by Barbara Hershey. And she's sort of repeatedly beaten and violently raped by an invisible demon. And she's frightened for herself and her children, and she initially seeks counseling because she suspects that she's just imagining it and it's her own mental illness. But as the attacks continue, she turns to parapsychologists to solve the problem. It's sort of a play on the myth of the incubus, the demon in male form who lies upon sleeping women to rape and sexually molest them. So I'm just going to play you a scene now of Carla with her psychoanalyst and what he has to say about her condition. But it starts off first with her being visited by the demon. But don't worry, it's not going to be as bad as the previous. So what he was getting at there when he said one big one and two little ones, that's how she described her children. When she was asked, how many children does she have? She said three children, one big one and two little ones. So it's obviously some thing that he's suggesting to her, and she thought it was obscene. Sorry, just by the way, I hope nobody was offended by anything that I was showing. I heard the door slamming, but I'm not really sure what happened.
It was a ghost.
Yeah. I thought it was somebody like leaving because they were outraged by the scene.
Yeah, it's more worrying than that.
Oh my God, it is more worrying than that. Okay, I'm really sorry to, it wasn't my intention to start a seance tonight.
I think Freud walking disgusted at the incredibly amateur psychoanalyst. Oh.
possibly. So, anyway, so that was, basically these two scenes. I thought it was really vital to show them to you because, It sort of touches on these ideas, the way that we imagine Freud's original, you know, hysterical patients, convulsions, inability to speak, repression, and a very fearful, and sort of passively relating to the signifier in the symbolic order. And I think in this case also, I mean, I didn't show you any other clips from this film where she is physically really badly beaten by the invisible demon, but in this case she felt guilty because she enjoyed the experience and she felt she was ashamed that she'd actually had, you know, climax in the experience. But in any case, I find it also interesting to point out, one of the more recent, films that have been released about possession by a demon, Paranormal Activity. In that, there's a line that sort of describes demons as being an entity that relates to something non-human. One possessed by a demon cannot run from it. It will follow them. It might lay dormant for years. Something might trigger it to become more active, but it will eventually reach out to communicate. And I just find this description really interesting because it's almost interchangeable for repressed, you know, conflicts or desires that, you know, it's a sort of possessing agency. You can't run from it. Wherever you go, it's going to follow you, and it may lay dormant for years, but eventually something's going to trigger it, and it's going to try and communicate return of the repressed. You know, whatever that you've tried to forget about will haunt you and possess you in that way. So I thought it was an interesting similarity in the terminology that we use to describe repressed conflicts and demons. So just sort of moving on swiftly, because I want to leave a little bit of time at the end for a discussion. Just some of the things that we associate with the female body, which can often be seen in popular culture, you know, art, whatever, mainstream culture, as a source of pleasure and also simultaneously a source of fear. And it seems to go sort of gradually from, you know, this sort of strange fascination with the female body, a simultaneous attraction but also revulsion to various aspects of the feminine condition. Let's start with with it being considered very pleasurable. So we often fetishistic, voyeuristic portrayals of the female body focus on various body parts that are seen, especially in pornography or, films that are, portraying the woman in a seductive, aura. So those are the sort of, let's say, the we can name those body parts as generally perceived as a source of pleasure. And then, you know, we kind of gradually move on to the bodily functions and, you know, pregnancy, childbirth, lactation, orgasm, singular or multiple. It's still relatively in the domain of being perceived as pleasurable. Then we start to move into the fluids, and then we start to get that kind of association of revulsion, you know, with menstrual blood, placenta, milk and female ejaculation. And then it starts to get progressively worse with pathologies, imagining infections, miscarriage, endometriosis, barrenness. And then full-blown phobias emerge, colpophobia, the fear of female genitalia, and tocophobia, which is the fear of pregnancy. And out of these things emerge myths that within, you know, thousands of years, that get repeated over thousands of years about the wandering womb, vagina dentata, contaminated menses, and immaculate rape. And my thinking about this is it makes me think a little bit about the myth of Pandora, being the first woman, the first Helon Kakon, beautiful bad thing, beautiful evil. She came with a jar full of evils to let loose on the world. Her jar, the receptacle, can be, let's say, seen as a metaphor for her womb. And the myth of Pandora is very similar to Eve in the Garden of Eden, where Pandora gets given a jar and told not to open it, but she does so anyway. So she rebels against the instructions she's been given. And the evils of the world are set loose, you know, disease, pain, suffering. And among the evils, her jar also contains hope, which is an ambiguous, sort of ambiguously left in the jar for humans to either use or avoid. And so I'll just say a few things about Julia Kristeva's idea of the abject. Abjection here being the state of being cast off, a disturbance of conventional identity and culture. Abject, you could place it somewhere between the object and the state of being a subject, representing the taboo elements of the self. And the abject is very much outside the symbolic order. We can't articulate it. It's too fear provoking. And facing it can be traumatic. So it's the sort of repulsion of confronting filth, waste, a corpse, you know, having to confront something that was previously an object and then violently cast out of the world, having once been, a subject as well. And the monstrous and horror is rooted in ancient religious and historical accounts of bodily waste, decay, death, incest, corpse, but also the feminine body can be thought of as monstrous. Abject is the place where meaning collapses. You know, the driving force of the horror film genre is to confront what has been abjected. Objection of the maternal, the object that created us, you could say it's necessary in order to construct identity. And here there's a contrast between the maternal authority and the paternal law. So we have the pre-symbolic world of the mother, the universe without shame, you know, when the baby is still unable to do anything on its own and it's still, you know, doesn't have control over its bodily functions, cannot speak, and very much it governed. So this is this pre-symbolic, pre-linguistic world of the mother, and this is in contrast to the symbolic world of the father, the universe of shame, where the phallic agency has been very much established, and you're meant to kind of follow certain guidelines to be integrated into society. So Barbara Creed, she sort of has reference to this Kristeva's idea of the abject in her book, very good book, The Monstrous Feminine. And she says, when a woman is represented as monstrous, it's usually in relation to her mothering or reproductive functions, such as the monstrous womb, the vampire and the witch. And stereotypes of the feminine from virgin to whore define women in terms of their sexuality. Whereas Freud argued that woman terrifies because she appears to be castrated, in Barbara Creed, we hear a different point of view that actually man's fear of castration leads them to imagine the emasculating mother or lover. So in horror films, we tend to think of monsters as male and women as their victims, but Creed challenges this patriarchal view and presupposes a prototype of the monstrous as being the abject of the female body. So, a good, sort of terrifying image of the ultimate resistance to male sexual advances is the vagina dentata, the woman who has teeth in her vagina. So this is the ultimate resistance, the ultimate hysterical resistance to engaging in sexual activity. So I'm just going to play you a clip from Teeth, which is a film released in 2007. This is the last clip for the evening. It's directed by Mitchell Lichtenstein, released in 2007. He's actually the son of Roy Lichtenstein, the pop artist. So it's basically, just to set up the clip for you, it's showing us Don O'Keefe, which I find the reference interesting. O'Keefe obviously makes me think of Georgia O'Keefe, the painter who, you know, painted beautiful floral landscapes that looked very vagina-like. And if you look closely in this clip, Dawn is basically, she's sort of coming to terms with her anatomy and trying to uncover a sticker that marks her high school biology textbook of a representation of the female anatomy. So starts off with that, and then she goes off this research and thinks that maybe there's some abnormal adaptations occurring in her body, goes to see a gynecologist to ask if everything's normal and okay. But in the gynecologist's office, I don't know if you remember seeing, for those of you who've seen the film, in the gynecologist's office, there's all these paintings of what look like Georgia O'Keeffe's flowers. I think that was an interesting reference. So I'll just play the clip. And I find it quite funny, actually, this clip, so I hope you do too, anyway. So Teeth is a sort of comedy horror film about a teenage girl who has teeth in her vagina. Dawn O'Keefe, she's a spokesperson for her high school's Christian abstinence group. She wears a purity ring and has promised not to have sex before marriage. But a boy from her high school attempts to rape Dawn, and she inadvertently severs his penis with her vagina. The vagina dentata myth, you can really see it as a defensive resistance to sex forcibly defined by the possessive man. is the sort of male fears about sexual intercourse resulting in injury or castration, and female genitals unconsciously regarded as a trap, a black hole which threatens to engulf and cut men into pieces. The vagina imagined as a mouth from hell, a mouth of hell, a barred and dangerous entrance. And you know, it's interesting, in the scene, the research that she does, leads her to a line. You know, the myth imagines sexual intercourse as an epic journey that every man must make back to the womb, to the dark crucible that hatched him. So, and also just on her, you know, when she was cycling on her way to the gynecologist, there were these billboards of women, you know, wearing nothing but a bikini brief and with the word perfect emblazoned on it. And I found this was a good segue, you know, this sort of pressure on young women to be perfect as defined by advertising and popular sort of billboards like that. It made me think of femininity as a Sisyphean task. Sisyphus was punished in Hades to the eternal task of rolling a large stone to the top of a hill. And before reaching the top, the stone always rolled back down, forcing him to begin again. So it sort of evokes this sort of maddening nature of a Sisyphean punishment, consigning one to an eternity of useless efforts, pointless and interminable activities, unending frustration. And so in this sense, capitalism has created impossible conditions for women to love their bodies, ensuring that women are constantly in the grips of the multi-billion pound diet industry. And femininity in this, you know, in this context, is rebellious. You know, it is a multitude of things. It's burgeoning, demanding, arousing, painful, pleasurable, horrifying, voluptuous, awkward, and potentially life-giving, force. And there's all these sort of communities online. One of them, the Finspo, group, where young girls who have anorexia nervosa exchange pictures of their collarbones, what's called the bikini bridge, when you're so thin that your sort of underwear doesn't touch your stomach, like in the picture in the middle, and the thigh gap, which is that picture there. And these are supposed to be like status symbols of conquering the curves of femininity. And they're exchanged all the time as motivational pictures to continue dieting and to fit into, you know, particular size or whatever. And this Finspo thing, it has a sort of aesthetic overtones to it, referring to like fasting through metaphors of bodily purity, food as sin and corruption, and thinness through imagery of angels and angelic flight. You know, it's very, very disciplinarian, you know, self-starving and abstaining from all forms of indulgence. So it's very aesthetic in that regard. And anytime they see pictures of just a normal woman with normal proportions, whatever that means, just, let's say, not emaciated, they sometimes call it porny. You know, it's too porny, it's too evocative, it's too, sexually arousing. So that's interesting as well. Anyway, so I'm going to end on this note because I want to leave a little bit of time for discussion. And I just put up some things up there for to potentially, begin a discussion amongst ourselves. If you can name some other films that contain scenes of possession or convulsions. And also, I didn't touch on this in this session, but what about portrayals of menstruation, pregnancy, and childbirth as abject in horror films? And also, for those who've seen Paranormal Activity, I found it interesting because ultimately it wasn't so much the demon that was creating a mishap in the household. It was the fact that the boyfriend was always filming everything. And this sort of idea of how she reacted, her resistance to the camera and his male gaze, constantly devouring her, you know, constantly stalking her, that became almost possessive and demonic in a sense. And any other, you know, topics touching on the monstrous feminine in politics or popular culture or whatever you want to talk about. So I'll just open up. I think we can maybe if, stay 5 minutes past nine. We have 20 minutes. So anything you want to add? Or
I think one of the issues I have with a lot of the stuff that's been covered tonight is that film is pretty much all cultural forms actually default to the masculine, with the feminine as a subsection within that. So you don't get, I have, for instance, a book at home. It's the top 100 women artists of the 20th century. There's no companion volume, the top 100 male artists, because male masculinity is the default. Likewise with literature. You know, we have women's prizes, but then the normal prizes for literature per se, they're for everyone but predominantly men. And film's exactly the same. So everything we've got here is representation of woman as problem. And there doesn't seem to be any way in any of the stuff I've seen tonight where femininity is presented on its own terms. It's all mediated through the masculine medium of film, where women are, it's all kind of quasi-pornographic, it's all exploitative, and women are presented as basically psychological car crashes. Hysteria is a resistance to all of this, but this doesn't seem to have come up so far this evening. And I was just wondering what your thoughts were on that.
Okay.
Isn't the last film ironic? It's a piss take about fear.
Yeah, it's subversive. She's almost reclaiming the myth of the vagina dentata being forced upon her. You know, you have this problem, you're abnormal, you haven't adapted normally. But she, if you haven't seen the film, she sort of reclaims that problem and uses it to her advantage, and she seeks revenge against those who've wronged her. So yes, it is a bit of a piss take of the fact that, you know, she's put in a problematic position, that she's forced against her will into this place where she's the problem.
You get something similar with I Spit on Your Grave. You know, every now and again you'll get a horror film of the vengeful woman.
Okay.
But it's still woman as, you know, there's still something the matter with her.
Have you seen the film? Have you seen Teeth?
No.
I didn't find that at all. That she's portrayed as a vengeful, problematic woman at all.
Mm-hmm. What about the other films that we've talked about this evening?
Sorry, there's just a comment back here. Yeah. Sure.
I think the film allows you to kind of see, find for yourself what might be in her mind and what might be real. Which,
It
allows you to just choose whether it be you.
Project your own ideas of what you're feeling onto the scene that you're seeing.
Yeah, because a lot of the scenes you don't know, you question yourself. That is actually happening in your mind.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting because, yes, of course, you know, it happens all too often that women are put in that position. But the fact of the matter is these films are out there and they're being watched. And I just thought it was interesting to place them in a sort of context of a course and try and deal with this issue, really. I'm certainly not presenting these scenes and saying that, you know, I agree women are problematic. That's not what I'm doing at all. I'm just In fact, I'm doing quite the opposite. I'm trying to open up a dialogue about these films that are out there and certain representations of women, and just sort of evoke a feeling of these conditions of hysteria, of to borrow your word, resisting, resisting what has been forced upon them as a dominating discourse. I mean, of course, it would be interesting to look to write a whole course on representations of women purely from the point of view of women filmmakers, and just solely look at like Andrea Arnold, Jane Campion, Mary Herron, Catherine Breillat. There's so many amazing ones, and that would be a really interesting course in itself. But I thought it's interesting to really explore and examine the idea of being possessed by this very thing, this very problematic idea that haunts and possesses the woman's psyche and her body. Go ahead.
I was just going to talk about possession with that movie for a bit. Sure. So I watched that one after the Megan. For me, I might be taking the wrong angle here, but it was actually the husband who, he to me is the possessed one. He's possessed by jealousy. Mm-hmm. Yeah. He can't present what's going on with his wife. And she's actually, brilliant acting.
Yeah.
That scene just is unforgettable. And then later in the movie, at the end, and I don't know if these two connect, but I'm trying to piece it all together. But at the beginning of the movie, the husband's sitting in this room with these men, and he's come back from a mission, and they're questioning his sanity, I think. And shot
appears
all the way around the room, and circling him. Yes. And then at the end, he's in that room, he talks about the man with the pink socks. And
yeah.
It's he's actually working something out in his mind that's so disturbing and so distressing.
Sure.
That he may be projecting his own fears onto his wife.
Yeah.
And at the end, the minute you see the man with the pink socks coming up the stairs, I don't know. I don't fully understand
and he was resisting, and in a way she was, in her very physically driven acting, was actually capturing his anxiety, his neurosis, his paranoia in her body. She sort of captured that psychological angst that he was experiencing, and she was acting it out, and he was the one who was mostly in his apartment, or often you saw him, it was seen very, very similar to someone going through withdrawal symptoms from heroin, just sort of very paralyzed and unable to even to move, whereas she was, as you saw, extremely expressive with her body, verbally less so. She's very restricted, but definitely. And I find it interesting in that film because the object of, fear is given a form that no one really would expect. I don't want to give it away for anyone who hasn't seen it, but it's worth a watch. And it's not a linear narrative. It's very, it's very alternative, but I feel it does capture what you've said too about, he being the one who's resisting, who's in denial, who's not looking at the situation, and she's acting it out. That's interesting. Yeah.
I was slightly surprised you didn't get under the question of vampire.
Yeah.
This surely sums up the whole idea of, first of all, it's necrophilia.
It's sure.
It's female domination, control over the male. But they are ultimately in control of the ultimate vampire. I mean, does that fit into your idea of...
It certainly does touch on Julia Kristeva and Barbara Cree's understanding of abject and the monstrous feminine. I did look for films portraying female vampires, but I didn't. I found it difficult finding a vampiric female that sort of is the paragon of some hysterical fit. You know, it's very. I don't know if you guys can think of a good example, but I didn't come across an archetypal vampire who's also hysteric, is having, you know, a crisis of the psyche, is repressed. Because for me, vampirism is almost, you know, for me personally, the archetype of the possessed woman, the one who's controlled by a demon, fits much better with the structure of the hysteric than the female who takes charge and is vampiric, and she takes control of her own destiny and goes after, you know, her prey and ingests. I don't know about you, but that's the way I feel about it. But did you have a particular scene in mind or film in mind?
No, I was just thinking of the concept.
The concept, yeah.
You said that the female has the control, but she doesn't. But she's ultimately, they become vampires because of the ultimate.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Yeah.
The man is behind it. He's created this.
He's created her. So, you're saying so she's become. Oh, that's really interesting. Yeah. I can see what you mean. So the state of almost... being forcibly pushed into a specific type of discourse, the vampire's discourse, where and it does create a kind of incessant, never-ending hunger for continued ingestion of blood all the time, but it never actually ever satisfies the thirst for blood. That can be compared in a way to the discourse of the hysteric, where a woman is forcibly, you know, pushed, brought into a system where, you know, the system of patriarchy, of phallocentrism, of everything being dominated by the man, and a woman having to find her own identity within that system, but invariably, finding a never-ending thirst for the very thing that infected her. Ah, that's really good. I'm going to steal what you said in my next talk and I'll... No, I'll give you credit. That's really, really good. Interesting. You see, the discourse of the hysteric always produces further knowledge.
Where does Rosemary's Baby fit in? That's kind of...
Yeah.
Abject pregnancy.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a brilliant example. I mean, I would have included that in my talk, had I not previously talked about Rosemary's Baby in a previous talk here, and I was afraid people would think that I was just repeating myself, but that's a really, really good example. Yes, if I hadn't, in different circumstances, I definitely would have included Rosemary's Baby, because yes, absolutely, you know, the conception of her baby was completely riddled with, you know, all kinds of fears about the way that she conceived the baby, that it was in some sort of satanic ritual, and then all throughout her pregnancy, it was a really horrific one, where she went from just, you know, having her steak rare to just eating raw liver. The fact that her baby was conceived so that she could give birth on the 6th of June 1966, you know, like all these associations with this baby being problematic, demonic, some kind of curse, you know, from hell, you know, and everybody's conspiring against her. People that are giving her milkshakes, you know, are actually trying to poison her. They're going to steal her baby. You know, there's all these kinds of connotations with the worst fears that a mother could have about pregnancy and childbirth. That's a really, really good example.
Are there any other films that touch on it?
Pregnancy? Yes, actually. There's actually a film called Astronaut's Wife, which I don't know if anyone knows it, but it's Charlize Theron and Johnny Depp, and she's meant to be, you know, he goes off, he's an astronaut, and he goes off, comes back, possessed by an alien spirit of some kind. And when they have sex and she becomes pregnant with his child, she's actually going to be giving to alien twins. So it's, again, reinforcing this kind of idea. I mean, it's a lot more crude and less sophisticated than Rosemary's Baby, but it's playing on the same fears of an abject, monstrous pregnancy, monstrous womb. I'm sure there are other ones. Pregnancy. I know there's. Yeah, go ahead.
This is something to do with pregnancy, but
yeah.
Menstruation.
Yeah.
The mistake that for me it's carrying.
Yeah.
For sure. And that, yeah. You know, because it's a basic phase, and she gets her period in the shower at school, and
yeah.
She's horrified.
So yeah. Yeah, exactly, exactly. And the whole fact that when she does tell her mother, you know, what's happened, or when she finds out from a phone call from the school, the fact that, you know, then she performs some sort of religious ritual with Carrie to try and exorcise the curse from her, the fact that now she's, you know, she had the curse of blood, you know, it's really, really negative, and objectifying her menstruation. And also the way that she gets bullied for it, and you know, by the other girls at school, and the fact that also just the way it's made into this big deal by the principal. You know, he doesn't even want to look at her. He sends her home for the day and says you're excused from gym for a week. You know, it's as if like, you know, the world has ended or something. It's very, very cleverly done. And then the afterwards when she gets know, elected for to become prom queen, the fact that they throw pig blood on her, you know, this reference to blood again, and the fact that she's covered, you know, she starts the film, you know, sort of with blood stains, and she ends completely covered. Yes, that's a very, very good example of the feminine condition of menstruation as abject. I think we have time for one more question, and then we have to sadly say goodnight. But if you have any other comments. And just to say also, to touch on where we're going from here, next week we will be looking at the state of the condition of transcendence. So what happens to this hysteric in the clinic when she, you know, when she's going through the treatment, and what if she does have, you know, a sort of clinical epiphany, you know, that she manages to reorganize her signifiers and breaks this spell, you know, this possession of her, whatever it is that's haunting her, that's bothering her, that's possessing her body parts. And she experiences catharsis. So I'm going to focus next week on this precise clinical condition of, you know, the experience of catharsis, from a hysteric point of view, as appearing in various films. Film scenes, and so I'm going to integrate into that the ideas of evolution, of apotheosis, of transformation. So do come back to see you know, where this all leads to. Don't leave it here. It's not a good place to leave it. But thank you very much for coming.